Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. And become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 7, Episode 14. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four spine-chilling tales for you, all of them from author Richard Saxon, about burdensome births, devilish diagnoses, unusual occupations, and oceanic abominations. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first three terrifying tales. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Our first tale tonight from Richard Saxon introduces us to a gentleman whose date of birth is the gift that truly keeps on giving, but certainly nothing to celebrate about. Without further ado, I present to you, every year on my birthday, I have to die. I died for the first time on the 18th of August, 2006. It wasn't a particularly pleasant death, nor was it one that I expected. It was simply the random act of violence that destroyed my life, and it came out of nowhere. We were just relaxing at the pub, enjoying a few drinks after a busy day at work. It was my turn to buy a round of drinks, so I was trying to get the attention of the bartender. I felt someone punch me in the side. At first I thought someone had just hit me, but then I felt the warmth, and the rapid stream of blood pouring down my shirt. I realized then and there that I'd actually gotten stabbed. As far as I can remember, it wasn't even that painful. Still, my legs gave out under me and I collapsed to the floor. Even then, I was worried more about ruining my expensive suit, ignoring the fact that I might be dying. Oncoming death is funny like that. Everyone thinks they're the exception, that they'll get out from whatever horrible situation the universe has thrust upon them. At least that's what I thought, as the life drained from my body. The world around me just faded to black, and before I knew it, I had just died. Then there was the void. At first it was little more than darkness, only broken by weird shapes and colors in the distance. As I regained a sense of surroundings, I was dragged toward a new world, one without pain or suffering or death. All there was were people on a journey to different destinations. Whether they all had died like me, or if they weren't born yet, I didn't know. All I knew was that I wasn't afraid anymore. The worries, the anxiety, and all my fears had been left behind. A light appeared in the distance, endlessly far away. I knew that would be my final destination, my final purpose in the brief life I'd led. Unfortunately, I never managed to get that far. I was jolted awake in my own bed, soaking wet from sweat and shaking like a maniac. My hand reflectively clutched my side to cover up the wound I'd sustained, but it wasn't there anymore. In fact, I didn't have a single scratch on me. Had it all been a dream? My phone lit up on the bedside table. I picked it up to find dozens of text messages and missed calls. "Hey, man, we're at the pub. You coming or what?" The first message read, sent at 9:43 p.m. "Hey, Rick, where the hell are you?" The second message read, sent at 10:23 p.m. Then there were a couple of phone calls and another message. "I guess you fell asleep, or maybe you're getting lucky. Whatever, I'll drink another shot in your honor. Happy birthday, Rick." Then I had over 20 phone calls and a singular message that sent shivers down my spine. "For fuck's sakes, pick up the damn phone. Something happened to Danny." I immediately called back. My fingers were trembling both from anticipation and from the memory of what had happened only a night ago. Even if my death had been little more than a nightmare, I knew for sure that I'd met up with my friends at the pub. The phone rang three times and then Jake picked up. "Rick, is that you? Where the hell are you?" Jake asked with a panicked, tired voice. I don't know what happened. I guess I fell asleep. I half asked, half stated. "Danny got stabbed last night," Jake said without listening to my explanation. "Stabbed? How?" "I don't know. Some nutjob just walked up to him and stabbed him in the side." I almost dropped my phone in shock. Danny had been attacked just like me, in exactly the same place. A thousand thoughts rushed through my mind, but worry quickly became my main concern. "Is he all right?" "He's still in surgery. They're only letting his wife know about..." "Wait, here she comes." Jake put his phone down, but I could still hear the muffled sound of their discussion. Danny's wife seemed upset, but I couldn't make out the words. "Jake?" I asked. He's dead. Danny's dead." The next few moments turned into a blurry haze of information. We'd all known Danny since we were kids, and now he was just gone. The murderer never made it out of the pub. Apparently he got shot by one of the patrons as he tried to attack another guest. Still, I just couldn't shake the feeling that I was supposed to die that night. Regardless of what happened, time marched on without answers. Some of our co-workers quit after Danny's death, trying to hopelessly move on. I don't blame them. I also needed some distance. I never even told them what I had experienced that night. It wouldn't have helped them anyway. A year passed, and I hardly spoke to any of my friends. I started to get some semblance of normalcy in the wake of Danny's death, but that would all come to an end on the 18th of August, 2007. My birthday had arrived yet again, and I had absolutely no intention of celebrating it. Instead, I called in sick to work, bought a bottle of whiskey, and spent the day playing video games. By the time day had given way to night, I'd almost finished the bottle. Even as a rather large guy, the alcohol hit me hard. At around 9 o'clock, I just passed out in bed, awaiting a horrible hangover in the morning. I only woke up around midnight when I heard the front door forcibly break open, followed by footsteps and whispers. I tried to get up, still drowsy from the alcohol. As I took one step from my bed, I slipped and tumbled down onto the floor. It produced a massive crash, loud enough to alert whichever intruders had broken in.
"I thought you said no one would be home,"
a man stated angrily. "Don't worry about it. I'll deal with it." The footsteps moved quickly in my direction. I tried to lock the door, but they were too fast, kicking it open and knocking me back to the ground. A masked man entered my room holding onto a gun. He only spoke a single sentence to me before pointing the weapon at me and pulling the trigger.
"You should have stayed quiet."
Unfortunately, the man was a horrible shot. He aimed at my head, but it hit me in my throat instead. There I lay, drowning in my own blood, as I desperately gasped for air. I couldn't crawl away, and I couldn't call for help. I died on my bedroom floor on my birthday, just as I had a year earlier. Once the life finally drained from my body and the god-awful pain ceased, I was back in the world beyond. I walked through the same colorful dimension that lay just on the edge of life. I admired the shapes and colors as they passed. In the distance, I saw a tree with branches stretched endlessly far from its trunk. From each branch dangled a person, real but not existing in our world. I wanted to visit them, but that wasn't my destination, because just like before, I would awake in my own bed, unharmed by the events from the previous night. My phone buzzed, and I was filled with unfathomable dread. I still couldn't quite believe it, but I started to understand that someone would take my place in death.
"Hello?
Rick, it's Dad.
Your mother, she passed away last night."
A lump formed in my throat. I knew what was coming next, but I had to ask.
What happened?"
"The police say it was a burglary gone wrong. I don't know. I was working late. I should have been there." The discussion trailed off from there. My dad was distraught and could barely form coherent sentences. He blamed himself for not being there, but I knew the truth. It was my fault. During the next 2 months, he fell into a deep depression. I couldn't blame him. He'd just lost the love of his life. I moved in with him just to help him pick up the pieces. He put on a strong face, trying his best to keep the ship afloat, but I could tell how close he was to breaking down. "If only I'd been there."
"It wasn't your fault, Dad.
Had you been there, you might be gone too.
You don't know that."
But I did know, because the burglars weren't ever supposed to visit my parents' house. They were supposed to kill me. I had to come clean. I had to let him know the truth. But how could I? Half a year passed, and the secret ate at me. After everything that had happened, I still don't know how to explain it. Still, I decided it was time to share my curse.
"Dad, can we talk?"
"Yeah, what's going on?" he asked with a worried expression on his face. He knew me well, and he could tell a heavy burden was weighing me down.
I started by telling him about my first death, down to the smallest detail. Of course, it matched everything that people had witnessed in the pub that night, even the location of the stab wound. I told him Danny had taken my place in death and that I felt guilty. Naturally, he was skeptical at first. But then I told him about my mother. I didn't spare him any details. I told him where I'd gotten shot, that the door had been broken down, and that there were two robbers. Every detail matched perfectly down to the letter.
I'm so sorry, Dad. It was my fault. I killed...
He just sat there in silence, processing what I'd just told him. It wasn't your fault. I was confused. There wasn't a single ounce of anger in his words, only overwhelming empathy.
How could you say that? She didn't have to die.
He mulled over his next words carefully before speaking. You didn't do anything wrong, Rick. You just went about your life, and these things happened to you. I don't know why you've been brought back, or even how, but you're not to blame for what's done to you.
So you believe me?
I asked. He nodded and embraced me in a hug. Suddenly, I wasn't alone in the world anymore. Someone knew what was happening to me. What if it happens again? Then we'll get through it together. He stood by these words, even as my next birthday rolled around. The death was tamer. I just slipped in the shower and broke my neck. The last thought that went through my mind as I left the world for the third time was, how fucking cliche. Once again, I woke in my bed. I called out for my dad, making sure he was still alive, horrified that he might have taken my place. I couldn't even breathe until he came rushing to my side, asking what had happened. I broke my neck, but I'm fine, I think. It took a while before I figured out who had taken my place that time, but once I had heard my boss had died, something broke inside me. He was the kindest man I'd ever met, and just like me, he slipped and broken his neck. That was the final straw. It was neither some bizarre coincidence I could brush off, nor a premonition. I decided then and there that I couldn't live with the responsibility. I had to put a stop to it, even if it meant giving up my own life. I figured that if I took control of my own fate and killed myself outside of my own birthday, maybe I could prevent more people from dying. First, I left a long letter to my father, explaining why I'd chosen to leave. I couldn't face him in person. I knew he'd just try to talk me out of it, but it was something I had to do. I couldn't allow any more people to die on my behalf. Alas, fate is a fickle bitch. No matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't end my own life. Tried hanging, but the rope broke. Then I tried to shoot myself, but the gun jammed. When that failed, I tried to drive my car into a tree, but I somehow survived that as well. Any attempt was met with failure. All I could do was wait for my next birthday and let someone die in my place. No matter how many times I tried, I couldn't die. I was a slave to destiny, and it was destroying me. In 2009, I was hit by a drunk driver, and my girlfriend took my place. In 2010, I drowned, and my kind neighbor had to go through that death. In 2011, I died from a brain aneurysm, which ended up killing my aunt. And so on and so on. Each year I'd die, and a person close to me would take my place. I kept trying to find a way out, but fate wouldn't have it. Years went by, and on the 18th of August, 2019, I would die for the 14th time. I'd already fallen sick a week earlier, much to the doctor's confusion. According to each and every laboratory value, I was fine, yet I kept getting sicker. My father and I both knew my time was near, but we also knew I'd be forcibly brought back. Then, at midnight on my birthday, my heart just gave out. I was jolted awake in my own bed, and the sickness was little more than a distant memory. "Dad?" I called out. No response. I got out of bed and called his name again. I was met with silence. I didn't have to call out a third time. I already knew what had happened. I carefully walked into his room, horrified at what I knew would come. He was dead, just gone from a heart attack. He'd taken my place, and I could do nothing to save him. The funeral came and went in a blur. The only noticeable thing was the missing seats from the people who had passed before him. Some of them had lived their own lives and died as nature intended, but a number of them were supposed to live on. Instead, they'd just taken my place in death. I inherited a number of things from my father. Among them, I found a letter addressed to me. It looked rather worn, so I could tell he'd written it a long time ago. "Dear Richard, today is your birthday, and it has officially been a year since your mother passed. While I miss her greatly, I'm thankful to still have you around. I know that if she was given a choice, she would want you to live. I feel the same way. We both know that I might one day take your place in death. Never doubt that I would happily give my life if it meant that you may live. You didn't choose this curse, so never blame yourself. Just do what every person is supposed to do. Appreciate the people around you, because you never know which day might be their last. I love you, Dad." Since I read that letter, I've been looking for a way out. My father might want me to stay behind, but how can I live on, knowing that I'm taking someone's place? I've long since left town, living by myself in a cabin somewhere away from people. Hopefully, if I have no one left that cares for me, people will stop dying. At least until I can figure out not only how to die, but how to actually stay dead. I'm sorry.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
I hope you enjoyed "Every Year on My Birthday, I Have to Die," as written by Richard Saxon and performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that first story and would like to see more of Mr. Saxon's work and help support him while you do, I'd like to encourage you to pick up a copy of his collection of stories when it's released, and sign up for his mailing list to get the latest updates on its progress via a link on his author profile at creepypastastories.com. To check it out, visit simplyscarypodcast.com/Saxon. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Saxon, spelled S-A-X-O-N, and you'll be redirected to our horror fiction website, creepypastastories.com, where you'll find links to Richard's mailing list, where you can sign up today to be notified of updates regarding his latest collection of tales
as well as access his Reddit and Facebook profiles, where you'll find a veritable smorgasbord of his previously released tales. Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. It means a lot to both of us. Up next, we've got a second tale of terror for you, courtesy, once again, of Richard Saxon. In it, a man who has experienced more than his fair share of loss in life gets the scare of a lifetime when he discovers something decidedly alien in one of his extremities, something that lends credence to the idea that there are some things worse than death. Without further ado, I present to you, I found a lump on my arm. Now we're all going to die. Mortality's a weird thing. It hits you like a bag of bricks once you make it to your late 20s or early 30s. It's about the time when your family starts getting diagnosed with all kinds of disease, heart attacks, strokes, cancer. For me, facing mortality meant something as innocuous as finding an odd lump on my arm while showering. It may not sound like a big deal, but it's important to note that my younger brother died from osteosarcoma, a fairly aggressive bone cancer, and for him, it was nothing more than a small, tender, unmoving lump he found on his leg. Even then, it was too late, and he died a year later at the age of 7, which meant I was absolutely horrified to discover a similar lump on myself. Over the course of a few days, as I awaited my doctor's appointment, the lump grew ever so slightly. It had a strange shape, like a column of bone that hurt to touch. During the examination, the doctor looked at me with concern in his eyes. It pretty much confirmed what I already suspected, that the growth was bone and that it would probably turn out to be cancer. He didn't hesitate with referring me to a radiologist and told me to return once the imaging had been done. A few days later, I returned, and as I sat in the office on the brink of tears, a thousand thoughts ran through my head. What to tell my sister? How to spend the remaining time left on Earth? Would it hurt as much as it did with my brother? At the very least, they'd certainly have to amputate my arm, which would severely compromise my gaming abilities. Can you even drive with one arm? Then the doctor called me in. He didn't seem concerned, but baffled, as if he hadn't the faintest clue what was wrong with me. After some consideration, he finally started speaking, unleashing a jumbled mess of medical terms and incomprehensible sentences. He took a deep breath before finally stammering out, It's not cancer. Despite the presumably good news, he didn't seem relieved. There was something he held back. Then what's wrong? I asked. It's a tooth. He couldn't explain it any further, so he just showed me the X-ray. Even with my limited anatomical knowledge, I could see it clear as day. A tooth was growing straight out of my ulna, its roots firmly cemented in the bone, while the crown pushed on the surrounding tissue. On one hand, it wasn't cancer. On the other, I had an impossible, bizarre growth extruding from the wrong part of my own skeleton. The doctor sat down with me and explained the concept of teratomas, a type of benign tumor that frequently grows hair, skin, and partially developed organs. Despite its unusual presentation, we settled on that idea and scheduled me for surgery. It was a quick and simple procedure. A couple days later, they discharged me and told me to rest a bit before returning to work. I was content, though admittedly a little bit disturbed by the whole ordeal. Life went on and my arm healed up nicely, the scar almost completely covered up by the inappropriate amount of hair I started growing during my teenage years. A couple of weeks passed, and the surgery was all but a distant memory. Then, after a morning of increasing back pain,
I found blood in my urine. Doctors will typically tell you not to get all riled up just because you found blood in your piss, because it could be caused by pretty much anything, and might not be blood at all. However, I did worry, and with a sense of panic, I rushed to the emergency clinic, where they quickly tested my urine to confirm the presence of hemoglobin. That, alongside my back pain, made me feel confident I was suffering from nothing more than an innocent little kidney stone. One of the interns performed an ultrasound scan just to rule out cysts and whatnot, but her casual demeanor quickly turned to an expression of fear as she put the sensor against my skin. She excused herself and left the room, only to return after 10 minutes, dragging with her an older, presumably more experienced doctor. He seemed annoyed to have been called in for something as simple as an ultrasound. He grabbed the device without introducing himself and tried looking for a kidney. Just as with the intern, his annoyed confidence quickly turned to one of worry, and he, too, left without explaining what the hell was going on. By then, my discomfort had turned to excruciating agony. They'd already put me on an overabundance of painkillers, but it barely put a dent in the suffering I had to endure. I stood up to grab hold of the doctor, ready to demand answers, but once I got to my feet, my vision started fading and I collapsed to the ground. From there, my memory was hazy. A combination of pain and drugs put me in a trance-like state. I vaguely remember being taken for some sort of scan, and a tube being shoved down my throat, and finally, everything turned black. It would take me 2 days to awaken once more, at which point I was greeted by a team of specialists, all looking way out of their depth. They explained as best they could that I'd fallen into a coma following severe internal bleeding and that I was an inch away from death when I was brought into the operating theater. I'd almost died, and if not for an insane stroke of luck, I wouldn't have realized. Despite the success of the surgery, they still seemed nervous, and I could tell there was more to the story. After a lot of talking around the point, and even more bizarre medical terms I couldn't possibly comprehend, I got mad. Just tell me what the fuck is happening to me. The oldest of the bunch finally stepped up and started explaining himself. Mr. Woodcomb, to be brutally honest, we haven't the faintest clue what kind of affliction you've come down with. Quite frankly, it's beyond anything we've dealt with in the past. What does that mean? Am I going to die? I asked. He took a deep breath. We can't know how the disease will progress, but what is happening to me? I yelled as I tried to sit up, still too groggy from the drugs, unable to feel the presence of my own body. He explained what had happened to me, that my stomach had started migrating toward my left flank, where it had enveloped itself around my kidney, slowly, but certainly absorbing and digesting it. The process obviously severed its blood supply, which caused the bleed that almost killed me. They'd fixed the tooth, and they stopped the bleeding, but a part of me knew it wasn't over. I'm still not fixed, am I? I asked. He shook his head. I'm so sorry, Mr. Woodcomb, but this disease, we don't know how to stop it. At this point, we're just treating the symptoms. By then, I'd woken up enough to coordinate my movements, but I still couldn't feel my right arm. I turned my head to check on it, and I saw that the vast majority of my lower and half my upper arm had turned almost completely white. I tried to lift it, but my muscles simply wouldn't budge. The skin looked so smooth, like perfect silk covering an almost shapeless blob. I'd always been a skinny, albeit toned person, so my veins were fairly prominent. Except that now, they'd all seemingly vanished from my forearm, leaving nothing but a stump of a vessel I could see actively retract away under my skin. It happened just before you woke up. There was no time. We couldn't.
What the fuck is happening to me?
I asked once more.
We don't know, he said.
I looked at him in despair. These were the people that were supposed to help me. If even the professionals were baffled, I was screwed. Mr. Woodcomb, your arm has absolutely no blood supply. I'm sorry, but we need to amputate it as quickly as possible. You shouldn't even be awake right now. They made me sign a consent form before proceeding. Just the act of writing my own name with my one remaining functioning arm was an excruciating ordeal. Another few hours went by, and my right arm was part of the past. Once I woke up from my third surgery, the doctors informed me that I was to be transferred to a more specialized health facility. They didn't even have the courtesy to call it a hospital. They airlifted me, wrapped in a containment box of sorts, to prevent the spread of the disease that could potentially be contagious. While flying, I was strapped down with no view of my surroundings. Wherever they were taking me, they wouldn't tell, and based on the few glimpses I got of the world beneath us, I wouldn't have known anyway. On the ground, I was met by a team of doctors dressed in hazmat suits. The health facility looked more like a warehouse than anything else, and didn't ease the growing fear within me. They rolled me through an airlock, ensuring nothing infectious could get in or out. The inside of the facility was a massive, isolated room with hundreds of patients lined up next to each other. No rooms for privacy, nor drapes to keep them apart, which meant that they all probably suffered from the same condition as me. One of the patients stared at me. He panted with shallow breaths, as his chest had transformed into a thick wall of bone, each rib fused together, making breathing an almost impossible task. Another younger woman had skin that seemed to be shrunken a few sizes too small, stretching to the point where it had become a pathetic cover of epithelium, allowing her muscles to be clearly visible. But the worst was the patient in the bed next to mine. All his limbs had been amputated, and the entirety of his skin was covered in thick, bright red arteries, some of them actively bleeding, while others had been burned in a futile attempt at cauterizing them. He groaned in agony, almost inaudible, strained sounds emerging from his toothless, tongueless mouth. His eyes and nose were missing, replaced by seemingly healthy skin, simply grown over most of his orifices, including his ears and scalp. He was trapped in pain, unable to hear, see, or communicate with the world around him, but if he could, I'm certain he would have begged for death. After a couple of hours of staring at the horrifically mangled people around me, a doctor approached me. He was a tired-looking old man that had been broken by the afflictions of others. I'm Dr. Foreman. Your name is Eric Woodcomb, correct? I nodded. I'm going to administer a drug. It'll slow down the progression of the disease.
Will it help? Can you please help me?
I asked frantically. He looked around, seeming to check if anyone could hear us speak.
It'll slow it down, but it won't cure it. We're not even sure what causes this disease. But antimitotic drugs seem to put it into a sort of stasis.
What is it exactly?
I asked with a trembling voice.
It's an infection, Mr. Woodcomb, though it's not bacterial, viral, fungal, parasitic, or prion in origin. All I know is that it affects anyone that touches it, and that we're not going to be able to contain it for long. I then asked a question I already knew the answer to. And I'm going to die?
He just nodded, his emotionless face never changing.
How long do I... I said, before he interrupted me. A week, maybe two.
Once the disease has converted all of your organs to an incomprehensible mess, and when even the most experienced forensics team would be unable to recognize your corpse as that of a human being, that's when you'll die. His bedside manner left a lot to be desired, but it was obvious that he'd gone through that speech 100 times before. He was detached, desensitized from the nightmare that surrounded him. As he turned around to leave, I noticed his arm had bone spicules, skeletal spikes protruding through his skin. "Doctor, your arm." He looked down at it and sighed. "I told you it was infectious. Everyone in this room, staff, patients, even the fucking dogs that have lurked around the site. The guys outside wearing hazmat suits have been hunting them down, but it's too late for that. Not that their fancy protection gear will help them, but I'm not going to break that news to them." I was speechless, and he could tell his words hadn't comforted me in the least, but he just didn't care. "I'm sorry, but you should make peace with your family, friends, whatever you have in this world, because if we don't find a viable cure, within the next week, they're torching this place." As the days progressed, they kept bringing in more and more patients. Some looked mostly normal, healthy even, while others were unrecognizable, their faces replaced by a solid mesh of flesh and their organs relocated to the surface of their skin. One of them had his heart placed outside of his chest, beating as if nothing had happened, with thousands of additional arteries extending from it, like a red spiderweb covering most of his torso. The pain must have been too much, because as he walked past my bed, he grabbed his own heart, attempting to rip it off. A few of the arteries tore open, splurting crimson all around him, but the heart itself wouldn't budge. He groaned, and with one final pull, he fell dead to the ground, clutching a clump of meat he'd managed to pull from the now-dead heart. As they lifted his lifeless body onto a stretcher, I got a better view of his face. I realized that I'd recognized him. He'd been the doctor that examined my lump, the tooth stuck in my bone. He died because of me. On the 5th day of my containment, I started to lose vision in one of my eyes. I could feel it pulsating, growing within its socket, but I didn't dare look at myself in the mirror. A few hours passed, and suddenly I felt a pop, followed by the sensation of a viscous liquid trickling down my face. My eye had exploded, and still, I didn't have the guts to put myself in front of a mirror or to call out for help. In a couple of days, they'll burn this place to the ground in an attempt to prevent the disease spread of whatever disease has infected us. The doctors aren't hopeful about a cure, but fire seems the safest option, just turning us all to ash. A price worth paying to save the world, I suppose. At least they've given us a chance to call our loved ones, but I don't have much of a family left, so to speak. The thing bothering me the most is that I'll most likely die without knowing what killed me, where the disease came from, and how I could have avoided it altogether. Hindsight's 20/20 and all that. Not that it matters to me. I'm already dead, but whatever finally got me, it's still out there. I hope you enjoyed I Found a Lump on My Arm, Now We're All Going to Die, by author Richard Saxon, as performed by yours truly. Up next, we've got a third dose of darkness for you, once again from Mr. Saxon. In it, we once again descend into the rabbit hole of death. In this tale, however, our protagonist is not on the receiving end of the Reaper's sickle. He's tasked with the bearing witness to the unavoidable consequence of other people's lives, their deaths. Without further ado, I present to you, my job is to watch people die. Once your time on this earth ends, death will greet you like an old friend. Whether you embrace it with fear, hatred, or acceptance is a question that cannot be answered before you stand at its door. I can't tell you what comes next, nor can I offer you comforting thoughts about an eternal afterlife. All I can promise you is that when it happens, you won't be alone. Up until Thursday, the 6th of December, 2007, I'd never considered myself anything out of the ordinary. As a teacher at the local high school, the best I could hope for was to aid in building our future. Though not an easy job, it was one I loved. Then, on the evening of the 6th, as I returned home after grading a bunch of unsatisfying essays, I received a text message from a hidden number. It contained nothing more than a time, a place, and a vaguely familiar yet generic name. Friday, 5:34 a.m., Lock Road 4, Juliet, Florence. Any logical person would have arrived at the conclusion that the message had reached the wrong recipient. Yet, as soon as I lifted the phone and read the message, a shiver shot down my spine, and something within me felt compelled, beyond any reasonable explanation, to go check it out. The road itself was an hour's drive out of town, situated in a desolate area, only occupied by abandoned farms and barren fields. It would have been the perfect place to lure someone out and kill them without anyone ever knowing. Despite this horrific fact, I wasn't worried. All I felt was compassion for whoever else would be there, without understanding why. I couldn't accurately explain the immense feeling of purpose that had arisen within me. It was an odd mixture of unrelenting fear, sadness, and pity. It felt as if my entire life had led to that very moment, and then nothing mattered more than being at that location at that time. Friday morning arrived, and I'd been lying in bed without a minute of sleep in anticipation of what would happen. As 4 a.m. rolled around, I attempted to sneak my way out of bed, careful to not wake my sleeping wife, Anna. Of course, it was a futile attempt, with Anna being the lightest sleeper on the planet, able to sense my thoughts and waking up because she claimed they were too loud. "Alex, what's wrong?" she asked, without even opening her eyes. "Nothing's wrong. I just need to catch up on some papers," I lied. "But why would you think something's wrong?" "You had a worried breath," she mumbled, already drifting back to sleep. I let a brief smile slip and kissed her on the forehead. "Everything's great, Anna. I'll see you after work, all right?" She mumbled something incoherent in response, and I left the house. Secrets had never been an aspect of our 5-year-long marriage, but on that particular day, I couldn't bring myself to tell her the truth. On the hour-long drive over to Lock Road, 1,000 questions flew through my mind. Who'd sent the message? Why did Juliet Florence sound so familiar? And what compelled me enough to risk following the instructions, or lack thereof, from such a cryptic message? It was a dark journey through the barely illuminated skies of dawn. Though the sun still hadn't peeked up from the horizon, it still gave the sky a deep blue hue. Once I got close to my destination, I noticed something down the road. It was a car that had flipped over, crushed under its own force as it had crashed into the ditch. I stopped my car and quickly approached the wreck, already preparing to dial 911. "Help!" a weak voice called from the car. In the driver's seat, pinned between the dashboard, steering wheel, and seat, sat a woman with a large piece of metal protruding through her chest. The debris had lodged itself into the seat, making it impossible to get loose. But even removing it would almost certainly have killed her, as it was the only thing keeping her from bleeding out. With shaking hands, I called for an ambulance. We were practically in the middle of nowhere, meaning it would take the ambulance almost half an hour to arrive, which would be more time than the poor woman had left.
"I hurt so much," she cried weakly.
A feeling of helplessness washed over me, as the fact of her imminent death became abundantly clear. I could do nothing but keep her company as the life drained from her body.
"I didn't think it would be like this," she said. "I'm so scared."
"You'll be all right. Help is on the way," I lied. She reached out, trying to remove the piece of metal lodged in her chest, worsening the bleeding.
"You have to lie still."
Despite my orders, she kept trying to move, mumbling incoherently to herself. I decided my best bet would be to keep her mind occupied on simple questions, keeping her mind working as we waited for help that possibly couldn't get there in time.
"What's your name?"
"Juliet."
What's yours?"
"I'm Alex. What were you doing all the way out here?"
"Alex?
Oh, no, I'm sorry," she said senselessly, barely audible before she started to lose consciousness.
"No, no, Juliet, stay awake."
I said it loud and with purpose, awakening her for just a moment. During the last few seconds of her life, she just stared into my eyes and whispered for the second time,
"I'm sorry."
Then she stopped breathing, and I could do nothing save wait for the ambulance to arrive. I felt numb, empty after having so futilely witnessed someone's life end suddenly and unexpectedly. The emergency services came to the scene and took her lifeless body away, while the police asked me a couple of questions to clarify what had happened. She seemed so familiar, and she responded so oddly when I told her my name, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I returned home without going to work. Anna had the day off and immediately noticed something was off about me. I broke down and told her about the accident. I told her I'd watched the poor woman die, confused and afraid, and that I could do nothing to help. What I didn't tell her was that a text message had told me to be there, not because she wouldn't believe me, but because something deep within me prevented me from uttering the words. She embraced me and tried to comfort me by saying that I did my best to help her, that at least she didn't die alone. It was a minor detail, but had I not been there, she might have just faded away, rotting for days before anyone else passed down that desolate road. That should have been the end of it. Weeks passed, and I slowly got over the trauma. Then, as I headed to work one cold morning in January of 2008, I received another message. It contained a time, a place, and a name. Jeremy Brooks. This time the address was a local motel, only 5 minutes away. I wasted no time and called an ambulance and got in my car to drive there myself. Being far closer than the hospital, I arrived before the ambulance. I rushed inside the apartment complex and barged through the unlocked door. There, on the couch, a man sat that I presumed to be Jeremy, pale as a sheet, and bleeding profusely from large gashes on each of his forearms. It was apparent that he'd slit his own wrists, and he simply sat himself down as he awaited his rapidly approaching end. He looked up at me with a fearful expression on his face.
"Who are you?"
he said as he fell over, too weak from blood loss to keep himself upright. I grabbed a T-shirt off the floor and wrapped it as tightly around his arm as I could. Even with three layers, it hardly seemed to stop bleeding.
"Come on, don't do this. Stay with me," I said as I looked for something better to wrap around his wound.
Despite my best efforts, there was little I could do for him. Jeremy tried to sit up, but in his weakened state, he just kept slumping over. Then a light lit up in his eyes, as he was hit with the realization that he wanted to keep living. A wish that came to him all too late. "Please help me," he said. "I don't want to die." Whatever trouble had led him to the stage, whatever had convinced him it would be better to leave Earth behind, he was wrong, and he knew it. But I couldn't help, and by the time the ambulance arrived, I'd watched yet another person's soul fade away. Over the next month, I'd receive another 7 messages, all with the signature time, place, and name. 7 people destined to die alone and in pain. I tried everything I could think of to prevent their deaths. I called the police, but they could do little without any evidence that something horrible was about to happen. Next, I attempted to reach out to the dying people, but to no avail. Not a single person accepted that I could provide them with future insight. By the time they died, the 8th number arrived. I had long since decided to just ignore them. Why expose myself to the harsh reality of death if I could do nothing to help? Of course, that just happened to be the one time Anna was looking over some photos she'd taken of us together. The message interrupted our session, and she immediately started questioning me. Oddly enough, I'd shut off notifications, yet the message came to taunt me at the most inopportune time. "What's this?" she asked. I quickly snatched the phone out of her hand, but the damage was already done. "What was that message?" she repeated sternly. "It's nothing, honestly. It's just something from work." I lied poorly. "Alex, don't bullshit me. You've been acting weird for weeks." It was true. My random disappearances, my denial that anything had been wrong. I couldn't hide it any longer. I don't... The words got stuck in my throat. 1,000 thoughts ran through my mind. I knew how suspicious it all seemed. I expected accusations of cheating, a hidden drug addiction, or worse. But instead of questioning me further, she just took my hand and said, "Look, whatever is going on, that you're too afraid to tell me, we'll get through it together." While we stood there with tears welling up in my eyes, someone knocked on the door. It was the police. "Alex Moore?" one of the officers half asked, half stated. "We're here regarding the death of Juliet Florence, and we need to ask you some questions." I followed them without hesitation, telling my wife to call our lawyer, but even with his help, no one could explain why I'd been at the scene of the death of not only Juliet, but 7 other people. They questioned me for hours, and I can provide few answers. Though it was an extremely bizarre situation, most evidence pointed toward the fact that I'd been helping the victims and not killing them. In the end, they let me go, but the investigation was pending, and at any moment, they could have come for me. Once I returned back home, I already missed the death of the 8th victim, whoever he was. He had died during my interrogation. I broke down and told my wife everything. If the investigation ended up with evidence going wrongfully against me, I needed her to know the truth. We sat down and I told her my story. I went over each and every death I'd witnessed and expressed the absolute hopelessness that lingered over me for each and every day. It was an unbelievable story, but she didn't stop once to question the validity of what I'd said. She just listened. When I finished talking, once all the facts were laid out on the table, she looked at me, her eyes glistening from tears forming in her eyes. "Alex, I'm so sorry," she said. That was it. No accusations, no follow-up questions regarding the validity of my story, just pure compassion. We kept talking throughout the night, where we would go from there and how I'd dealt with watching all those people die. Then, as if a light bulb had been ignited between us, Anna came up with an idea. "What if you're not supposed to save them?" I looked over at her, expectantly, awaiting for the next part of her suggestion. What do you mean? Why else would I be sent their way just moments before their deaths? What if you're just supposed to be there, by their side? Maybe all you're meant to do is give them some comforting words as they pass. I mean, you've tried everything possible to save them, but in the end, wouldn't they have just died alone if you weren't there? I let her words sink in for a moment. It was an almost ludicrous idea, yet it gave me the most profound moment of peace. More bliss and hope than I'd felt in the past 2 months. She was right, there was no logic behind the feeling, but I knew it had to be true. So I patiently waited for the next message, and it wouldn't be long before it arrived. As it so happened, it would be my next-door neighbor, an elderly woman whose name I barely knew, but who I know had become a widow last year after her husband lost a long-winded battle with cancer. I walked over to her small house next to mine and knocked on the door, fully aware that she'd be dead within the next couple of hours. She was a lonely woman, eager just to have someone to talk to, and I regretted not spending more time with her before. She'd always been friendly to me, offering cake when she baked, asking about my work as I passed by in the mornings, but I'd always been too busy to appreciate it. I made no attempt at warning her about her ultimate fate. Instead, we just talked. She told me stories about her husband, and I just listened intently to each word she spoke. She smiled as the memories flowed back, ones of a life well spent, a happy one. As her time grew closer, she started feeling tired. I offered to make her some tea, and by the time I came back, she'd fallen asleep, never to wake up again. On her face, I could see an expression of peace, and I knew she hadn't been afraid. She'd been ready, and I hoped whatever afterlife existed would reunite her with her husband. From then, my curse became more of an ally. It was a job I had to do, to watch people in their last moments and comfort them as they left our world. I did my due diligence and alerted the authorities after each event, but it was nothing more than an anonymous tip, enough to lead them to the scene, but not enough to add suspicion. I simply held their hands or gave them a few words of comfort. I tried getting close to them before their last hour, be it just to strike up a friendly conversation or to buy them a drink at a local pub. And most left with a look of acceptance, as if they trusted my assurances that everything would be fine. Years went by, a whole decade of helping people pass peacefully to the other side. The power I'd called a curse so long ago had become a welcome gift. Then, in the late days of last year, as Christmas rolled around once again, Anna and I were wrapping presents for the holiday festivities and family dinners. I'd gone almost a month without receiving another name, but that would end quickly when I received another message that shattered my life with these simple words. Saturday, December 7th, 11:43 p.m. Anna Moore. I froze in place and just stared at the name highlighted on my phone. Anna quickly noticed my absence from rapping and jolted me back to attention. "You got another name?" she asked. I nodded, not needing to speak another word for her to understand. The look of horror on my face said it all. "Oh, how long do I have?" she simply asked, her normally cheerful voice turned dull and empty. "We need to go to the hospital," I demanded, knowing fully well that preventing the deaths was an impossible feat. "Alex, don't," she said before I cut her off. "We can stop this. It doesn't have to happen." We argued for a bit, and she seemed oddly calm throughout the discussion. In the end, she agreed to get a checkup, if only to calm me down. Of course, with a woman that appeared perfectly healthy, without as much as a cough, the doctor could only run her through the basic tests. To look for anything substantial was a futile task, as most tests would take weeks to return, which was time we didn't have. In the end, we were sent home without a single answer.
What if we leave? What if he just got out of town for a few days? I suggested.
Has any of the 100 people survived? She asked. She already knew the answer. I didn't have to say it out loud. Without a place listed in the message, it became apparent that she'd meet her fate wherever she was. So we decided to make the best of what little time we had left. The following days, Anna stayed brave, putting up a beautiful facade of acceptance and joy. We reminisced about the times long since past, looked over photos and held each other for hours. At night I could hear her cry in the living room, terrified not of what was to come, but of what she'd leave behind. I did my best to comfort her, but there was something hidden under the layers of love and support. Resentment. "I wish you'd never told me," she said. "You should have just let me meet my death, ignorant like everyone else." She was right. I had taken away one of the most beautiful things about life. Its uncertainty. The idea of our temporary, fleeting existence here on Earth. The fact that any moment might be our last. The thing that makes us so tragically wonderful. And I'd taken it away. Despite that, she never stopped loving me, and on her final day, she made me promise to never give up. There would be people that needed me after her demise. They would be alone at the final step in their life, and I couldn't let them down. Once her time came, it was nearing midnight, we both agreed not to mention her rapidly approaching death. She asked if we could go outside to just look at the night sky one last time, to kiss under the moonlight, like we did on our first date. But it wasn't meant to be. No sooner had she stood up than she collapsed to the floor with no warning. According to the doctors, my wife had suffered from a deep vein thrombosis. Basically, a clot had formed in her leg, to subsequently break off, traveling all the way up to her lungs where it caused a pulmonary embolism. It killed her within seconds. The love of my life had died, yet the names never stopped coming. I was depressed, broken, and without the will to follow orders. I wanted to ignore the names, but I made a promise to keep going. For the next 2 months, I chased down dying names as I got them. 5 victims that didn't have to suffer alone. I approached them, made them feel comfortable, and held their hands as they passed. But each name crossed off my list, took away chunks of my own soul. Without Anna to support me, I had no energy to keep going. I just had to wait until whoever ruled my life finally released me from my curse. So I did, up until last night, when I received another message, one that differed from the rest. This time, there were no names, no places, nor a time. I was faced with nothing more than an innocuous question. Are you done? My mind raced. It was such a simple, yet overwhelming question. What would happen if I said yes? Would I finally be free? I thought long and hard, before deciding that I fulfilled my duty, that my time had come to let go and let life happen the way it was meant to. Yes, I typed into the phone. Within a second, I got a response. Who will be next? Then it clicked, as if the past decade of my life suddenly made sense, or at least partially. Juliet, my first job, had not only been a random death, she'd chosen me as a successor, plunging me into a life she herself had lived. Why she'd chosen me remains a mystery. Maybe we knew each other long ago, met once, and the name stuck, or maybe she picked me from a dusty phone book in her attic. But just like her, I'd been faced with the same dilemma. I thought about the implications of choosing another person to suffer the same fate as myself, but before I could consider a name, another message popped up. Sunday, 8:49 p.m., Hollow Street 7. Alex Moore. By quitting my job, I effectively ended my own life. It's not a fate I'm trying to escape, and I've already come to terms that I don't have much time left. Though I still have a few days to sort out my business, there's still one question that remains. Who's next? I hope you enjoyed My Job Is to Watch People Die by author Richard Saxon, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed the tales you've heard tonight, I'd like to remind you one last time that tonight's featured author has a book coming out soon, and you can get more information about it via his mailing list. But you need to sign up to get updates. So you can sign up for his list as well as access links to Richard's Reddit and Facebook profiles by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Saxon. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Saxon, spelled S-A-X-O-N. You'll be redirected to our horror fiction website, creepypastastories.com, where you'll find all the links I just mentioned. And you can sign up for the latest updates on Richard's debut collection of frightening fiction, coming soon. Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. It means a lot to both of us. Before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining me for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs. Or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Story Time, dating back to 2014, and you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.